When this is done, you can test for depth of trance as follows. Your body is now heavy because you're so relaxed. So very heavy as you're so relaxed. Your body is now heavy and your legs are heavy and your arms are heavy, heavy and relaxed. Your right arm is heavy, heavy and relaxed. So very heavy, heavy and relaxed. Too heavy to lift, it's so heavy and relaxed. Your right arm is so heavy you just can't lift it up. It's too heavy to lift, because you're so relaxed. Too heavy to lift because you're so relaxed. Again, the suggestion is repeated until you feel it should take effect. If your subject responds, he will find himself incapable of lifting his arm. Once you're satisfied, reassure him at once. There is nothing to worry about. He is safe and well, perfectly relaxed. And his arm is now back to normal. Already your subject is in a very light trance. His body is calm, completely relaxed, his breathing deep and regular, and he is responsive to simple suggestions. But he is still perfectly well aware of his surroundings and will remain so, even should he pass into medium level trance. The mistake is often made that unless a subject loses consciousness, he is not in trance. This is not so, as experience will soon show you. It is no bad idea to tell him this, keeping your voice low and regular. Then tell him he is going to pass into a deeper level. I'm going to count to 10, and as I count you will fall into a deeper level of sleep. As I count to 10, you will fall deeper asleep. Deeper and deeper asleep as I count to 10. Apostrophe now do so, slowly. Reinforce your suggestions between each count and continue to reinforce them a little while after 10 is reached. Then test again. Tell him that this time his arm is growing stiff and rigid, although the rest of his body will, of course, remain perfectly relaxed. If reaction is positive, release the arm and suggest his eyes are now locked shut. Tell him that the harder he tries, the more difficult it will be to open them. When this suggestion has been sufficiently reinforced, invite him to try to open his eyes. Allow plenty of time for this test. In my experience, it tends to be fairly crucial. Should your subject find he cannot open his eyes, tell him they are back to normal, but ask him to keep them closed. Even if he managed to open them, remember to suggest strongly that they have returned to normal after the test. Another count to 10 should produce deepening of trance to middle level. This can be tested by suggesting his arm has now become so light it is floating in the air of its own accord. A further, indeed probably the best, test for medium level trance is the subject's response to post-hypnotic suggestion. The term is used to denote actions suggested by the hypnotist, but carried out by the subject after he is awakened from trance. These should be kept simple until you are sure deep trance has been reached. You might, for instance, suggest the subject borrows a box of matches, or goes to sit on a different chair. The actions may be triggered by a key word or gesture from the hypnotist. If nothing else, hypnosis can be used to promote relaxation prior to an astral trip. But the most interesting relationship between hypnosis and the astral appears at deep trance level. Signs of deep trance, assuming your subject is one of the 20% who can reach it, are his ability to open his eyes without affecting the trance, positive reaction to complicated post-hypnotic suggestions and hallucination. Once the hallucination stage is reached, you are dealing with a level of the astral plane. Your subject has passed through his personal hypnotic doorway and is conscious only of an astral environment. His link with the physical plane is your voice and your instructions. In most cases of hypnotic experiment, the subject's experiences on the plane are meaningless. He is told he is at a soccer match and builds the astral environment accordingly. His hallucinations are not even his own. They're random ideas tossed out by the hypnotist. I am indebted to the French psychologist Paul Golden for putting me on the track of a much more useful astral operation. Golden developed the technique of suggesting to subjects that they take underscore an unspecified trip anywhere they wish to go. Since the only other suggestions given are that they will return when told and remember who they have been, the results of this technique are often very interesting. Much material is, of course, the result of purely subjective factors such as wish, fulfillment, But some hypnotic trips appear to go beyond this. It was, in fact, as the result of a series of hypnotic experiments that I began to pay more attention to the occult DHT of the futural plane as an objective reality. Down P 72. Chapter 10 The Hypno-Astral Experience. In time, no doubt, all these difficulties will vanish, and we will have the beginnings of a rational theory of parapsychology. Until then, we should perhaps not be too critical and remember that we have no proper theory of most psychological phenomena either. H. J. Eysenck, Sense and Nonsense in Psychology. Conscious attempts to use hypnosis as a key to the astral came after I stumbled on proof of its usefulness while trying to do something else. I discovered Denise Alexander while on a trip to Northern Ireland. She was working at the time as a shop assistant in a chain store. An attractive, completely extroverted girl in her late teens, she had no interest in or knowledge of the occult. She was, however, easily the most remarkable hypnotic subject I had then encountered. Denise not only had the capacity for deep trance, but she reached the level with almost alarming speed. She reacted positively to every test I thought to apply. On more than one occasion, she spontaneously went into deep trance while watching me work with someone else. Denise enjoyed the hypnotic experience and was consistently willing to undergo it. She was highly intelligent and very observant, two qualities which added considerably to her value as a subject. At the time, I was interested in the problem of establishing some first-hand evidence of etheric projection. To do so, I set up the following experiment. A couple, mutual friends of Denise and myself, planned to leave their house vacant while on holiday. I arranged that before leaving they should write a short letter, the contents of which were known only to them. This letter should be left on the mantelpiece in their living room. During the period of our friend's holiday, Denise agreed to visit my wife and myself as a house guest. At some stage during the visit, Denise would, under hypnosis, attempt to travel to our friend's home in the etheric body and there read the letter. The reason for the rather tortuous holiday arrangements was that I wanted to rule out, so far as possible, the question of telepathy. Our friends did not know exactly when Denise would make her attempt. And, whenever it was made, they would be absent from their home, presumably thinking of other things. Denise passed into trance with her accustomed ease on the evening of the experiment. I suggested that she was leaving her body and traveling back towards her hometown. The distance involved was about 100 miles. She responded positively and I then directed her to go to our friend's house. Had she arrived? She had. Would she go inside and enter the living room? She did so. Was there a letter on the mantel, please? There was. At this point, results took a dramatic downwards turn. I asked Denise to read me the letter. But she refused to do so. She became agitated and said she could not. I asked the trouble and was told she could not see it. I then suggested she go closer, which she did. But still she could not read the letter. Why not? It was, she said, too dark. This was a complication I should have expected, but did not. I tried to remedy it by suggestion. I told her it was getting lighter in the room. She accepted the suggestion and agreed. Could she now read the letter? No, it was too dark. I then suggested she was moving back to the doorway and told her to switch on the light. Again she accepted the suggestion. The lights were now on. Could she read the message? No, it was too dark. I had almost resigned myself to total failure when, on some irrational inspiration, I asked how many words were in the letter. 5, Denise replied promptly. What color was the paper? Blue. Was it lined or unlined? Lined. Was the letter typed, handwritten or printed? Hand, printed in block capitals. All these answers later turned out to be accurate. I considered the experiment a qualified success and determined to repeat it. Later I did so, but not with Denise. This time Arthur Gibson stepped in, with staggering results. Arthur had a very different temperament to Denise. A man of about 40, he was fascinated by the occult. He had lived in India for several years, where he studied Fa and Mantra Yoga. He had some direct experience of spiritualism and a knowledge of the esoteric, made remarkable by the fact that he had never read a single book on the subject. His information was gleaned partly through discussion and partly from meditation. By nature he was both emotional and introverted. Father witnessed the experiment involving knees and volunteered as a subject for the next one. I was not enthusiastic. On several past occasions I had tried to hypnotize Father without the slightest result. I believed him to be one of the immune 15%. But Father insisted things would be different this time and reluctantly I agreed to try. As it turned out, he could not have been more right, nor I more wrong. To my astonishment, he fell quickly into deep trance. Soon he was responding to post-hypnotic suggestions even more complex than those used to test Denise. There was not the slightest doubt he had become a first-class subject for etheric experimentation. But I, in my cynicism, had been taken unawares. No rigid experiment had been set up. What followed was decided on the spot. To that extent results arose out of chance circumstances. But the results were striking. Using the golden technique, I suggested Father take a trip anywhere he wished. Then I left him to it for perhaps 10 minutes. When he awoke, he remembered his journey, but not the fact that he had been hypnotized. He had, he reported, flown to India. He described the plane and remarked that the flight had been a pleasant one. He found himself in Bombay, a city with which he was quite familiar. He went sightseeing. Further description of Bombay could easily have been drawn from memory, so it is pointless giving them here. As he told us about his journey, a certain confusion began to creep in. He could not work out how he had suddenly returned to Ireland. I reminded him that his experience had been under hypnosis, but he did not believe me. He was convinced in time, of course, but the fascination with his vision remained. He could appreciate that the scenes he had witnessed might be no more than dramatized memories, but two things puzzled him. He had visited a favorite restaurant in Bombay and discovered it had been completely redecorated. And in one part of the old city, he found a wall newly built where none had been before. He could not understand why his memory should begin to play tricks at these points. Besides, the whole thing had seemed so real. It was real. Arthur wrote to a friend in India for information. The restaurant, he found, had actually been redecorated. The wall he saw had actually been built. So far, the experiment pointed to etheric projection. Arthur agreed to try again. This time controls were tighter. Instead of sending him on an unspecified trip, I suggested he visit a neighboring house. I was familiar with the interior layout of this building, but he was not. He made the trip and began to describe the interior with striking accuracy, down to details like the nature of the paintings on the walls and the view from one of the windows. At one point he insisted a firestone had been moved from its proper place, a detail I was unable to confirm at the time, but which later turned out to be accurate. Once again it seemed on the face of things that Arthur was an etheric projection. Yet, with the mass of detail that was accurate, he produced simultaneously a good deal of material which bore no relationship to physical reality. This was particularly evident when he described people he saw in the house. A very similar situation arose many months later with a different subject. This girl projected to the old church. She described the Tocatiti reassurably well, but added detail which had no physical parallel. That there was a distinct connection between her vision and the church as it stands today was shown when she led a party there, without guidance, in pitchy darkness, taking her directions only on the basis of her vision. In trying to evaluate these experiments, the inaccurate data seemed iota at least as significant as the hits. The suspicion crept in that we were dealing with something other than etheric phenomena. This suspicion was confirmed when Son Gordon became a subject in the series. An engineer in his early 20s, Sam, had recently joined the Merchant Navy at the time he took his first important trip. Previously he had experimented quite successfully with the dot elemental doorways. Hypnosis increased the reality tone of his visions, but not to a degree where he would make the mistake of thinking the experience was physical reality as Father had done. To Sam, the whole thing was rather like going to the cinema. Sam wrote the following account of his experience, delightfully titled, A Journey from One Place to Another. I am in the desert. There are sand dunes. The journey begins with me on a half horse, half donkey animal. I feel half priest, half soldier. The street is fairly narrow with few Arab, like traders on each side of me. They are selling brass and copper goods, but not to me. On my pure white mule, dressed in scarlet and gold and wearing a cardinal's hat, I pass under three arches and then out of town and into the desert. In front of me and to my left is a great pit. I cannot see to the bottom of this, but there is grass and red areas low down. I keep well away and continue on my trip. The ground rises towards the horizon. The wind starts up and I am in the middle of a sandstorm. I have the idea that while the storm is on, I'll make time, so I beat the mule with my whip. Soon I realize that this is not good at all and I let the beast alone. The storm stops. Below me is a shallow valley with a stream running down the middle of it. To my side, sand and nothing else. On the other side, a tract of darker sand supporting some vegetation. The sand is darker because it is in the shadow of a great white cloud. In this darker region is a walled city. That's where I'm going. The walls are a muddy gray. I go down the gentle slope to the river and cross at a wooden bridge. A soldier, Spanish type and armed with a lance, comes my way. Almost half way across the bridge, he steps close to one side and lets me by. I give my mule a chance to munch a few blades of grass, then we have to be on our way. Guards are at all the gates and doorways, but the mule takes me on. Anyway, everybody clears out of my way, or the mules, and we step into a white palace or the like after climbing a lot of steps. On my right and left are two rectangular swimming pools, but I take little notice. There is a greeny tint about the floor here. There are also a few people, but again I take little notice. I climb many white marble steps. There are red carpets and curtains about. I think I can see the throne, but I am looking for the king. But my journey ends. The abrupt ending, curiously enough, was not because he had been recalled. For some unconscious reason, he terminated the trip himself, although remaining in trance until awakened in the normal way. I think it goes without saying that this trip was not an etheric projection. The cardinal's hat, if nothing else, would rule this out. Indeed, at the time it seemed sheer fantasy. But Sam went to sea, and 4 months later found himself in a fair approximation of his astral environment. He wrote from the Middle East in some excitement detailing parallels and requested some attempt be made to see the continuation of the trip, which, he was convinced, would indicate a future port of call. To comply with his request, I sought the help of Bea Van Vliet. She had never met Sam, but had, under hypnosis, demonstrated a curious clairvoyant ability. On April 5, 1969, Bea went into deep trance and under detailed instructions followed the course of Sam's earlier trip. When she reached the throne room, she continued the vision without further instruction. According to notes taken at the time, she met a richly dressed man who asked Jem to want to show her something. They went into a long gallery with arches, and from it the man pointed towards a truge fit. In the valley was a large Fuabic type city with a path of brick steps leading down towards it. As Bea watched, Tfi's sky darkened and the city changed. Divergent structures emerged. From the architecture and wall paintings, Bea recognized the environment as Mexican, for various reasons. Sam never received a report of this experiment, but that made no difference to the outcome. His next port of call was South America. Down on page 79, chapter 11. The Objective Astral. This book opened with a quotation from Ahaz Levi. In subsequent chapters I have tried to narrow the credibility gap it must have produced. By now, my own reports on any experiments yo_umalhrn tried with the doorways should have persuaded you there is more to the astral plane than mere imagination. But if the frill is not just imagination, what is it exactly? This is not easy to answer. And answers that might be given are difficult to prove, except in the manner that puddings are proved. The standard occult answer requires a modification of the basic diagram which appeared in Chapter 1. This modification has been made in Figure 8. Now the solid black area representing the astral plane extends both right and left of the line marked self. It is now seen as touching on the physical as well as mental levels. It has become, if you like, the imagination of matter. I have noticed this term used more than once in occult literature. It is expressive, but unfortunate. The connection is too easily made that occultists believe matter to be sentient, a difficult proposition to back up. It might be easier to suggest that various physical features, trees, streams, mountains, produce automatic stresses in the astral, by reason of their existence. This no more introduces sentience than the fact that a mountain can influence an air current. Although the definition of the astral plane has now been extended, its essential nature remains unchanged. It is still a fluid, plastic medium, having no form in itself, but capable of taking any form impressed on it and capable of giving form to underlying forces. Earlier these forces were considered to be mental. Now we accept the possibility that physical forces can work on the astral as well. From this viewpoint, many a magical operation suddenly starts to make sense. The ritualists' words of power, for instance, or witchcraft's chanted spells involve, at very least, the production of sound, wave patterns. Sound can shatter a wine glass, draw patterns in a plate of sand or, if you happen to accept the story, demolish the walls of Jericho. It is not too difficult to suppose it might also influence the astral plane. Repeated movements may do the same. Reinforced by the imaginative workings of the magus, this possibility lies behind all magical ceremonial. Occultists make one further postulate, that influence works two ways. Matter acts on the astral plane to produce patterns of change in its structure. But patterns established in the astral will also produce changes in the material world. This latter reaction is considerably more difficult than the former to put into effect, but it is the basis of virtually all magic involving the physical plane. This is not to say wishing will make it so, even combined with a vivid imagination. I have a fair idea what the inside of a television set looks like, but no knowledge of electronics. I know that an arrangement of wires, transistors and other equipment can produce pictures on a cathode ray tube. But if I were to build a set only on the basis of this knowledge, it would not work. The position with astral magic is exactly the same. Without proper training in the detail of an astral operation, the tyro is in a similar position to the cargo cultist who builds a wooden runway to attract the great metal birds full of white man's goodies. A detailed examination of future magic is beyond the scope of this book. The subject is mentioned here to give an idea of the fascinating possibilities which lie beyond those doorways. If you will forgive a curious statement, I think some of the other possibilities are a lot more important than producing miracles with which to amaze your friends. I base this statement on the belief that there is another plane beyond the astral. If you agree, then we need to start working from another basic diagram. The first figure was fine, so far as it went. But the geography is wrong once you add a further plane. Occultists call this area beyond the astral the spiritual plane, assuming everybody knows what is meant by spiritual. It is a dangerous assumption. Everybody does indeed know what is meant by spiritual, but the knowledge is so personal that it is useless in a wider context. You will see exactly what I mean next time you listen to students arguing about the real nature of God. Each one has his own views and backs them with as much skill and information as he can lay his mind on. But at the end, nobody is nearer to God. And the reason is that their argument is verbal. There is a neat way to spark a textbook verbal argument. Never use it on graduates in logic, because they know it already. For the rest, it is set up thus: in the middle of a field there is a single tree. Clinging to the bole on the eastern face is a squirrel. Standing in the eastern corner of the field, in direct line with the squirrel and facing towards it, is a hunter with a gun. The hunter wants to shoot the squirrel. The squirrel becomes aware of the hunter and, not wishing to be shot, begins to edge around the tree, hoping to get the trunk between itself and the hunter's gun. The hunter, determined to beat this maneuver, begins to move in the same direction, always keeping in direct line with the squirrel. After a few minutes, Both the squirrel and the hunter have completed a full circuit of the tree. The problem now becomes, did the hunter go round the squirrel? This problem divides an unsophisticated audience into two opposing factions. One maintains that the hunter does indeed go round the squirrel. Because he is, in sequence, to the east, to the south, to the west, to the north, and finally back to the east of the animal. The second faction maintains that the hunter obviously does not go round the squirrel. Because at no time is he to the side or to the front of it. If it seems obvious to you that they are arguing in the last analysis about the meaning of the words go round, you are quite correct. But it is not obvious to everyone. And it is less obvious when the subject has more emotional appeal than hunters and squirrels. A discussion on the true nature of God, snipped of its emotional content, is a discussion about the meaning of the Lord God and nothing else. Exactly the same difficulty, and a very similar emotional content, presents itself when you use a word like spiritual. All of which leads me to define what I mean by the word. If your first reaction is to disagree, remember that the subject of disagreement is the word, not the reality. The spiritual plane is to the mental plane what the mental plane is to the astral plane. It is perfectly permissible to consider the astral plane as billows of fine matter. From this viewpoint, the mental plane, the psyche, is held to be composed of finer matter still. From our definition, the spiritual plane is composed of the finest matter of all. It is equally permissible, although slightly abhorrent to empty, to consider the astral plane as a level of higher vibration. The mental plane is a higher vibration still. And the spiritual plane becomes the highest vibration of all. These are more or less standard occult viewpoints. Even allowing for the fact that they need not be taken too literally, I dislike both. It seems to me very evident that in the astral we are dealing with a state totally alien to the physical. As such, the only worthwhile way to consider it seems to be as a different reality we can experience but not measure. Ideally, the position should be left at that. Unfortunately, it will not be. The human mind has a tendency towards analogy. So the mental plane will be described as finer or higher than the astral. And the spiritual plane will be thought of as finer or higher still. Although these ideas communicate something, they still amount to saying blue is finer than GR10, or scarlet is redder than crimson. The way out of the maze is to remember you have direct experience of both the astral and the mental planes. To page on top 85. Note the connection between the two and form your own link, by analogy, with the spiritual. But do not try to put your conclusions into words. Once you do so, you are back in the maze again. With a fourth plane to consider, the new basic diagram might look something like figure 9. Figure 9. The four planes, the innermost sphere of the diagram represents the material universe, to all intents the planet Earth. Beyond it, like an onion skin, is the astral sphere. Beyond that, the mental. And beyond that, the spiritual. These are not, of course, geographical locations. The astral does not circle the universe as the Van Allen belts circle the Earth. In this realm you are dealing with a different state of affairs. Once you pass through a doorway, you have entered non-geographical space. You have also, by the look of things, managed to sidestep time. If you have already tried an astral trip, the chances are you will have noticed a distortion in your time, sense. I once guessed at 20 minutes for an inner journey that lasted, objectively, an hour and a quarter. This may, of course, be simple disorientation. But disorientation does not explain how to journey's predicted Sam's next ports of call. With this sort of picture then, you have layers of pseudo-space extending for, dimensionally into pseudo-time, wrapped, around, or, more accurately, intermingling with the physical plane. It is assumed that each layer can interact on the other, with automatic interaction strongest at the closest point of contact. A fairly natural series of subdivisions follows these ideas. That knot of Tyre astral closest to the Earth takes on form from Earth influences. Part of this form is purely a mirror image of physical conditions. But the remainder, is the form aspect of emotional thoughts from Earth's inhabitants. Psychics maintain this lower istrate level is not very pleasant. Unless your view of mankind is very naive, you will have no trouble realizing why. Beyond the lower astral, conditions grow more attractive.